respective of the time, the final points that link the Jesus of the New Testament to the Messiah of the Old. But just to know that what we have been teaching was part of Jesus' own claims. And after the resurrection, he gave a lesson that was very similar to what we've been doing in these last seven studies. And that is evidenced if you will turn to Luke 24. Last chapter of Luke. The resurrection has occurred, and Jesus is on the road, and the disciples remain blind to the Old Testament prophecies about Jesus the Messiah. And they do not see the link. Many will try to say, well, the apostles, they forged one. They were so excited and they so wanted him to be the Messiah that they forged their own link. That's not true. They walked with him. They heard him teach. They lived with him. They saw him die. And at the end, they simply still did not see the link. So they weren't men fired up with enthusiasm saying, let's find it. And that is can be a very, very easy mistake to make when you're studying something. If you want to find it badly enough, you may be able to find it, though it's not really there. And you can't argue that with the disciples because they went over and over and he taught them clearly, but they did not catch it. And we have now seen him dead, he has been buried, and now he is raised and he's making an appearance. And we break into that down to verse 24 of Luke 24. They're on the road to Emmaus. They're walking there. They're in despair. Oh, and let's go back even further. Verse 13, behold, two of them were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, which is about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were conversing with each other about all these things which had taken place. Why did this happen? What happened? Did you notice this? And all of the conversation that would be entailed in that. And it came about, verse 15, that while they were conversing and discussing, Jesus himself approached and began traveling with them, but their eyes were prevented from seeing and recognizing him. So still at this point, they're not bursting with enthusiasm. They believe he is dead, and even when he appears and begins to talk to him, they still do not see that. But as you come down to verse 24, some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it exactly as the women also had said, but him they did not see. And the whole problem is involved in the Messiah is going to suffer, and they couldn't grasp it. And so in verse 25, he said to them, Jesus speaking, O foolish men, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken, was it not necessary for the Christ, for the Messiah, to suffer these things and to enter into his glory? In other words, can't you see a suffering Messiah? Can't you see what has happened in front of your eyes? Haven't you read it in the prophets? And the obvious answer to that is no, they had not seen it in the prophets. And so, verse 27, and here is where he began his series on prophetic bridges. Beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. So notice the approach to the disciples after the resurrection to convince them that he was truly the Messiah of the Old Testament is very similar to what we've been doing in our study, which we will complete tonight. And so we're going to cover 21 things. We're down to number 10 is where we stop. When we stop with 9, the Messiah would be mocked. Number 10, Messiah, so the prophet Isaiah said, would intercede for those who persecuted him. The Messiah would intercede for his persecutors. He would not lash back at them. He would pray for them. And that is our 10th bridge that we want to look at. For the Old Testament, let's go to Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 12. And notice the concept here that talks about the intercession on the part of those who mistreat him. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great, because he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. And on the road to Emmaus, Jesus is saying, haven't you read that? It's in the prophets about the suffering of the Messiah. Have you missed it? So because he poured out himself to death, was numbered with the transgressors, yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors. So the concept then is those that are going to persecute him and sin against him, he will pray for them. New Testament, Luke, rather, chapter 23 and verse 34. Luke 23, 34. And let's back up as far as verse 32, really. It said, two others also who were criminals were being led away to be put to death with him. And we've already had that prophecy made in Isaiah. And when they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. But Jesus was saying, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And so notice that which was prophesied by Isaiah is that those who transgressed against him, he interceded for. And as he looks at that entire crowd, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, important note we might put in there, does that mean that ignorance was an excuse? Does it mean they could be forgiven simply because they did it in ignorance? Well, if we trace out and make the bridge over into the book of Acts, we know that this same crowd on the day of Pentecost was there and heard the preaching of Peter. And on that day, Peter said, you want to be forgiven? Whoever believes on him can be forgiven. And you had a mass of, what was it? 2,000? 5,000? 2,000? 2,000? 3,000? None of the above. 3,000 saved on that particular day. And of these 3,000, I would take it that probably the majority, maybe all, certainly a large amount of them, were present at that cross and were those who saw him crucified, and now he prays that they will be forgiven. And in the book of Acts, Peter comes along just a matter of days later and says, you want forgiveness? Here's how. It's by believing on him. So that the ignorance was the reason, but it was not the excuse for what they did. So, prophecy number 10. Number 11. The Messiah will be despised by his own people. The Messiah will be despised by his own people. And that calls for the fact that in the Old Testament, in fact in the book of Romans, Paul calls attention to the fact, to whom were the promises made? And in that great passage where he talks about chapter 9, the tremendous privileges of being an Israelite, and to be a Jew, to be an Israelite, was a tremendous privilege. Where did the prophets come from? Syria or Egypt? Or where did they come from? They were prophets from Israel. And therefore, the minute you pick up the Old Testament, we are looking at a Jewish book from beginning to end. Jewish prophets spoken to Jewish people, a Messiah who would be born of the seed of Abraham down through the seed of David, and therefore had a Jewish pedigree. And the Old Testament or the New Testament begins, Matthew chapter 1, by establishing one point. Jesus had a Jewish pedigree. And you could trace that back objectively throughout the genealogical records. So the Messiah is to be despised by his own. Old Testament passage, once again, Isaiah 53:3. Isaiah 53:3. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we did not esteem him. And I take it in this context that Isaiah is not just speaking we as a human being, but we as a Jewish prophet. And we, the Jewish people, did not esteem him. He anticipates for the future. Much is made of that in the New Testament. For example, John chapter 1 and verse 11. And John makes the comment, he came into his own, and his own did not receive him. Notice you've got, in the English, you've got his own twice. He came into his own and those who were his own. And it appears in the English translation as though his own would be a reference in both places to the same people. It is not. One of them is neuter gender. The first one is neuter. He came into his own thing, something neuter. And his own, and that has a gender to it, masculine, referring to people. And the common interpretation, I think one that is correct, he came into his own land, Palestine, his own place, and those who were his own, that is the Jewish people, did not receive him, and so forth. So notice the concept is the rejection by the people. John chapter 7, verse 5. And this is within the context of his own Jewish family. And the comment is made in verse 5. Not even his brothers were believing him. And if you let your eye go down to verse 48, a comment about the Jewish leadership and their relationship to Jesus in general. Verse 47, the Pharisees therefore answered them, "You have not been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he?" In other words, the consensus opinion is not one of faith in you in any sense of the word. The Messiah despised by his own people. 12. The people will shake their heads in both dismay and rejection at the Messiah. People will shake their heads at the Messiah, and it's not so much the physical motion that we're looking at as the fact that the shaking of the head was one of rejection and confusion and so forth. And that will be, for example, Old Testament, Psalm 22:7, and we'll add, without making this also, 109:25, two messianic passages. The first messianic passage is Psalm 22. Remember, as we said this morning, this is often called the Psalm of the Cross. And you come down to verse 7. Well, let's go back to 6. There's an interesting concept in verse 6 where he speaks of how he is despised. And the expression is, "I am a worm and not a man." And the word used for worm is particularly important, Hebrew word tola, which was used of a particular type of worm that had only one function and one use, and that was to be crushed. And as the tola was crushed, the fluids from the tola were used as a dye, a brilliant purple dye that was expensive and that was used in the garments of royalty. And it's an interesting figure that one which they, along with the Phoenicians, would understand as a worm to be crushed for the kingly robes that can be dyed from it. And it's an apt metaphor, because here is the Lord saying, or the Messiah saying, "I'm a worm. I'm for nothing but to be crushed. And not a man," that would be expressing it, not treated as a man, "a reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me will sneer at me. They will separate with the lip and wag the head." Psalm 109:25. There is an interesting book, and I can't tell you the name of it, or the rabbi that wrote it, but it's a rather fascinating account of a rabbi, and I believe the man was in Los Angeles, a highly trained rabbi, had been pastor of a congregation for many, many years. And he began to dig into the Old Testament and compare it with the New, and became convinced that Jesus was truly the Messiah. And as he proclaimed that one Sunday morning in his synagogue, in came two police officers, and they said, "We must remove you from the synagogue because of whatever," how they manipulated anything, I do not know, like that. It doesn't seem like it would be legal. Maybe it was not. But he's written a book on it, and it's a good one, and you might want to read it, but I don't know who wrote it, and I don't know who published it, and I don't know the name of it. But it's a good book. I'll find out what that is. Okay, Psalm 109 and verse 25. "I have become a reproach to them." There may be, in verse 24, another prophetic thing. Remember, and this is a prophetic section, Some take 24, verse 24, to be a prophecy of the Messiah when it says, my knees are weak from fasting and my flesh is going to lean without fasting, without fatness. And the weakness, again, was in the legs. And some have taken that, though I'm not completely convinced that it's a valid application, and taken it to what event in the life of Jesus at the crucifixion? Remember, he was forced, as was Roman custom, to carry his cross. And remember, he fell under that load, and Simon Cyrene took the cross of Jesus. Some make that link. I don't know. I personally think it's a little bit precarious, but nonetheless, especially since nothing is made of that in the New Testament, but perhaps. So verse 25, I also have become a reproach to them. When they see me, they wag their head. Same prophecy as we had in Psalm 22. New Testament, Matthew 27, 39. Matthew 27, 39. And while it seems to be a minute detail, perhaps that's part of the great force of prophecy, is that it is always fulfilled in minute detail, not generalizations. So in verse 39, as he was being crucified, there are those that pass by in front of the cross, and it says, those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying. So even the reproach indicated by head movement is shown in this particular passage. Number 13. The Old Testament said the Messiah will be hated without cause. The Messiah will be hated without cause. And by the way, when you look at Jewish interpretation of what these things would be with regard to the Messiah, there's agreement on that. The area of disagreement is, did Jesus fulfill those type of things? And it is the stance of the New Testament, Jesus himself, as well as the apostles, that yes, he did fulfill those particular things. And that's basically the argument that comes down in the book of Acts, is the attempt on the part of the apostles to convince them that this man that you've seen die, you've heard teach, you've seen perform miracles, is truly linked to the scriptures of the Old Testament. And thus, the Judeo-Christian position on Jesus as the Messiah. Okay, number 13, he will be hated without cause, Old Testament, Psalm 22, once again, and verse 7. Psalm 69, verse 4, linked to John 15 and verse 25. Psalm 69 and verse 4. And again, one that is known as a messianic passage. I am weary with my crying. My throat is parched. Christ spoke out seven times when he was on the cross, and one of those cries that he cried out was what? I thirst. And that's when he was offered the gall and vinegar, but that also was predicted. So you do have part of that in here. I'm weary with my crying. My throat is parched. Mine eyes fail while I wait for God. I'm reading verse 3. Why am I reading verse 3 when I should be reading verse 4? Those who hate me without cause are more than the hairs of my head. Now, is it true that David is speaking of himself? Sure he is. And he's speaking out about the multitude of enemies that he has. But characteristic of the prophecy of the Old Testament is the prophet speaks of himself and beyond himself, and that's the essence of prophecy. Or he speaks of his generation beyond his generation. He speaks of the present, he speaks of the future, and the way that usually is again in terms of, it simply telescopes out. He speaks of himself, and then the passage balloons to predictions that cannot apply to him. He speaks of his generation, and you see things that were true of his generation, and then it expands out and applies to things that cannot apply to his generation. That's the genius of Hebrew prophetic literature in the Old Testament. John 15:25. And notice, if you're looking at a red letter Bible, you've got lots of red letters. It begins back in chapter 14:23 down through this chapter 16, well in through chapter 17. So we're heavy into the discourse of Jesus. And in verse 25, he speaks of the mistreatment that he is receiving from those that oppose him. And in verse 25, he makes a direct link of his treatment with our passage in Psalm 69 and verse 4, saying, "But they have done this in order that the word may be fulfilled that is written in their law," quote, "they hated me without cause." And so notice, if in no other opinion, Jesus makes an emphatic statement, and he makes the statement not that just what is happening to me is like what happened back there or like what the psalmist said would be, but what is happening to me is what was spoken of back there, and he claims this to be a fulfillment. If Jesus was not a fulfillment of Psalm 69 prophecy, as he states in chapter 15:25, he was simply flat out wrong. If his motives were not correct and he wanted to make a connection and knew there was really none, but he stretched it, then he was a liar. But as we said before, he was mistaken. He was a liar. Those are all options. But that doesn't allow him to be a good man. And I believe it is completely inconsistent to say, well, he was a wonderful man. Wonderful men don't publicly lie. They do not make claims that are not theirs, and yet he did. And so I can have far more respect for someone who says Jesus Christ was an out-and-out flat liar, more than I can for someone that says he was a good man. To say he was a good man only says you're ignorant of what he really taught and what he really said. The other is at least an honest opinion, and one that I think is viable if you choose to go in that particular direction. 14. The Messiah will be stared at in his suffering. Now that carries a little more weight than it does with us, because in ancient cultures, when someone was being punished legitimately for what they had done, it was a sporting event, and it was an event that you would love to go to. And you said, "I don't want to miss the execution. I want to see them bleed. I want to see them die. I want to see them die." And it was a sport. It was something that people took pleasure in, and they loved to see you die. That would simply mean that in place of an execution being done at the prison, it would be done in Bartle Hall or someplace like that, so you could accommodate the crowd, sell concessions, and make some money and have fun at the same time. And I know that sounds to you grotesque, but that's part of ancient thinking. They thought to watch the execution was a great, great privilege, and the bloodier it got, the better it was. Psalm 22:17 again. Coupled with Luke 23. 35. And every time I mention that glee with which people got over supposedly the suffering of those that had done something unjust, I always go back to Indiana, Vivian Road in Indiana, coming up that little place where you can never get out, several years ago with when it was snowing, probably 6 inches of snow. And I was sliding, I couldn't make it, and a guy in a four-wheel came up behind me, and he was so impatient. And he whips around me on the right over the top of the fire plug, and I so long just thought that is the most wonderful thing that I ever saw. Psalm 22 and verse 17. 22, yes, verse 17. "I can count all my bones." This is within the context of the pierced hands and feet in verse 16. "I count all my bones." That would doubtless relate to the scourging where was part of crucifixion. That's where many, many died, at the strap with the glass or the iron in it would literally rip the flesh from the bones, and you could see some historical descriptions record seeing the inner organs and seeing bones exposed as the flesh was
torn off of the body. I count all my bones. They look. They stare at me. And notice in verse 18, we're going to have another prophecy. We'll be back to this, so you might want to just tab Psalm 22, because in the next verse, it says, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. But let's just take it an item at a time. Verse 17, they look and they stare at me. Luke 23:35. Finger here, because we'll be back to it. Luke 23:35. And the people stood by, looking on. And then you have the ridicule. But notice the emphasis is, this was a crowd who enjoyed looking at the proceedings as they were going on, as the prophet had said would be the case. Now going back once again to 23:18 of Psalm 22. Psalm 22:18 for our 15th point. And that is the garments. There's something about how they will be disposed of. The garments of the Messiah will be divided, and it will involve the casting of lots. Divided and lots cast. Psalm 22:18. And for our New Testament, we'll look at John 19:23 and 24. Psalm 22:18. And notice in verse 18, you seem to have two elements involved, the dividing of the garments among them. And I take it would be whoever has the authority to do such. And for my clothing, they cast lots. So there's a dividing and a casting of lots. John 19:23-24. Now again, let me remake one argument. If you want to say, well, the New Testament writers went back and they dug these things out, and the apostles got all enthusiastic about seeing these things. Keep in mind this point. After the resurrection of Jesus, Emmaus Road, Luke 24, they made no link whatsoever. They didn't see any of this. They weren't trying to concoct anything. That was not there. They had to be taught that, and they saw it later. So it's not born out of enthusiasm. It's born out of Christ's own promise. The Spirit will come. He will guide you into all truth. The supernatural element for them to see these things and so forth. So that, looking at John 19:23, the soldiers, therefore, when they had crucified Jesus, took his outer garments and made four parts, a part to every soldier, and also a tunic, and the tunic was seamless, woven into one piece. So notice the two elements. Number one is there was a division of the garments into four parts. But one of the garments they decided not to take into four parts. And how then are we going to divide? We've already divided the four up. What are we going to do with this one if we want to leave it in one piece? And the answer was, we'll cast lots for it. And that is found in 24. They therefore said to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to decide whose it shall be, that the scripture might be fulfilled. Going back to Psalm 22, they divided my outer garments among them, and that would have to do with the outer garments in four parts. And then for my clothing, that would be the tunic, they cast lots. And I would think in a prophecy, it would be amazing enough that the Messiah's garments will be divided. But it's more amazing yet to foresee that not only they will be divided, but one of them will be received not by an equal division, but by casting of lots. And that's the genius of much prophecy. It has the courage to be detailed. And the reason it can be detailed is not the genius of the prophet, but the fact that the prophet was speaking, thus saith the Lord, and therefore it is remotely possible that God himself should know how Jesus' garments would be disposed of. And that 500 years before it ever occurs, it is no surprise to God that there will be four divisions and one of the pieces will be cast for in terms of lots. If God is God. Of course, if God is not God, there is no God and there is no supernatural, then of course, well, explain it as you will. As he is crucified and suffers, the Messiah will thirst. The Messiah will thirst and be offered vinegar to quench his thirst. and not only to quench thirst, but this will happen two times, and in one of those it will be mixed with gall, which is sedation, and would have caused him to feel less than the pain of the cross. Old Testament passage, two of them, Psalm 22, verse 15, 69, 21. Psalm 22, 15. And the psalm reads, and the emphasis here is the thirst that was there in this passage. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws, and thou dost lay me in the dust of death, and therefore the dry mouth, the thirst. Psalm 69, 21. And we look at verse 20, and I'll put another one in about which I have some doubts, but in discussing prophetic prophecy concerning the Messiah, it says, reproach has broken my heart. That is often released, often linked to the piercing of his side and the blood and the water cast forth. And there has been, I think, a little over-enthusiastic teaching that this was indicative that the Lord's heart literally ruptured. And some have taught that in the time past, but that's a medical matter, so I don't touch that with for any reason. But you ought to know that some do advocate that idea. Verse 21, they gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink. And for that fulfillment, let's go back to two passages, Matthew 27, 34, and Mark 15, 23. I think these things really bring an issue because if you say, well, I don't agree with the link of these Old Testament messianic prophecies to Jesus. Well, one thing, and I hope I've been able to prove it because it is provable, even if you don't believe that, Jesus did. And you've got to do something with what he thought. Because he said, "This, I'm fulfilling this passage." And therefore, the options you have, again, are what? He was a shyster. He was ignorant. And he did this for his own ends. And you may do that. But one thing you may not do, you may not say he did not claim that. I mean, if you can read, he claimed it. And if he claimed it, then we've at least got to face that the documents say that he claimed that. Now, you can go back and take another approach and say that the documents, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are no good. And I would be prepared to debate anyone on that. The Bible text is the most thoroughly documented ancient document that exists today. You know how many documents you got of some of the classical Greek writers? How many manuscripts you have? One. Do you know how much distance is between the existence of that manuscript and the speaking of some of your Greek orators? 1,000 years? And you take the New Testament documents, of which there are thousands, that go within a matter of 100-200 years of when he was spoken, of when he had spoken as a scholar. I remember him like I remember the book. He was at Harvard. He was a Jewish rabbi. And he specialized in textual criticism, that is, the integrity of ancient documents, especially the Bible text. And he made the statement that the texts of the Bible are the most thoroughly documented texts in the world. He prefaced it by saying, I do not believe them, but they are documented, which is interesting evidence. Okay, Matthew 27:34. Matthew 27:34. 33 reads, and when they had come to a place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull, they gave him wine to drink mingled with gall, and after tasting it, he was unwilling to drink. So notice the offer, and also in Mark 15 and verse 23. I just caught it tonight. I'm doing something that is irritating me. I wonder if it irritates you. I need to change it. I will put down like Matthew 27:34, the verse, and then go to it and say we ought to pick up the context and then back you up to verse 23. And that's That's distracting, isn't it? I need to put those down for the full context. I'll try to remember to do that. Okay, so verse 23, they tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And so you have the fulfillment of that in Jesus. 17, the Messiah will cry forth words of abandonment. He will cry out his abandonment. Psalm 22:1. And you do not need to go to that because it's identical with Matthew 27:46. So let's go to the Matthew passage. Remember, Psalm 22 opens up with the words, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And we have in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 46. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, and he does so in Aramaic. And it is then translated saying, that is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And quotes what was found in Psalm 22:1, the Psalm of the Messiah. Number 18, no bone of his body be broken. This is a remarkable prophecy. Often associated with crucifixion was the breaking of the legs with a club in order to bring a speedy death. The reason that did it is the person would be extended upon the cross with his hands nailed. And obviously your whole body could not, you put nails in the palms of the hands, that could not hold your body weight. I mean, you would rip the flesh out from it. And therefore, the feet were crossed, and a spike was put in the feet. And very often, the cross would have a little pedestal on which the feet rested. And consequently, some of the weight of the body could be on the feet, so the nails would not pull through the hands, which obviously would not hold the whole weight of the body. Now, if the person is lingering and you wanted a quick death and part of the weight of the body was resting on the pedestal or down here where the feet are, what would happen if you broke the legs? Obviously, the total weight would then come down and the death would be... I'm sorry, that's the way they did it. B, I know it's grotesque, it's horrible, but nonetheless, this was the way it was done. And consequently, in order to, many times, suppose it is an act of mercy, we'll hasten your death by breaking the legs, or we want to get this thing over with, let's break the legs and be done with it. So number 18, then, it's prophesied that that would not happen to him. Psalm 34:20. This will not happen to the Messiah. Psalm 34:20. And again, the viewpoint is looking at the afflictions of God's people, and as is the characteristic of the prophet, this often goes beyond to something more, and this has always been treated as a messianic passage. Saying in verse 20, he keeps all his bones, not one of them is broken. John 19:33, in order to expedite the death of those three men on the cross, in verse 32, the soldiers therefore came. We're looking at John 19 now, verse 32. The soldiers therefore came and broke the legs of the first man and of the other man who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. And again, that relates, I think, to Old Testament prophecy. And we're looking at John 19:33. I'll put a couple of see alsos down, but we'll not go to them. You might want to see also in this Psalm 22:14 and also verse 17, which deal with the same concept. 19, the side of the Messiah would be pierced. Zechariah, the prophet, 12:10. John, for the New Testament, 19:34. Zechariah 12:10. The Lord says, I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication, so they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one who mourns for an only son. They will weep bitterly over him like the weeping for a firstborn. So notice the idea of the piercing of the Messiah. John 19:34. They do not break his legs, but for whatever reason, perhaps spite, one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately there came out blood and water. 20. The Messiah will commend his spirit to the Father, Heavenly Father. And our two passages are 1, Psalm 31 and verse 5, and New Testament, Luke 23:46. One more to go. Psalm 31:5, and again the prophet speaking of himself and beyond himself. Into thy hand I commit my spirit. Thou hast ransomed me, O Lord, God of truth. Into thy hand I commend my spirit. And then finally, Luke 23:46. And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. That takes us to his death. One last bridge. Number 21. The Messiah will be buried in the tomb of a rich man. Messiah will be buried in the tomb. Old Testament. Isaiah, the prophet. 53:9. And we close with Matthew 27:57-60. Isaiah 53:9. Interesting thing here is his grave was assigned with wicked men. As the three died on the cross, they would go to a common grave. And therefore he would be taken from the cross, as things would normally go under Roman law, and he would be put in a grave with the criminals that he was crucified with. Yet, Isaiah says, he was with the rich man in his death. So there was an assignment and a probability that he would go with wicked men, and yet that will not happen. He will be with the rich man in his death, Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27, 57. And when it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. The body was destined to be buried with the wicked or with the criminals. And so he asked it, and then Pilate, in verse 58, ordered it to be given over to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. And Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary sitting opposite the grave. So he ends up in the tomb of the rich man, the one designed as rich, as Joseph of Arimathea. And with that, I close what we have done 8 sessions on, saying that it is the evidence of the Old and New Testament that Jesus is the Messiah. And thus, reaching all the way back to the first promise of salvation, that born to the woman would be him who would crush the head of Satan. There are many more, but I think what we do about 42 should be adequate to build somewhat of a cumulative case. Father, thank you tonight for your word. May we recognize that this is not the newspaper. This is not a book. This is the book that claims to be the word of God and allows us to bear out by reference to history itself that these things be so, for which we give you thanks in Christ's name.